Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Judy Munson. She is the director of the International Collaborative for Public Health Emergency Preparedness, which is a long term for she helps us organize so that if some crisis, disease, chemical attack affects us, we're prepared. Judy Munson, With Respect. Judy, how are you this morning?
Absolutely fine. It's a beautiful day, and it's great to be here in Harbor Country.
This is good. Judy, I gave a long title to you.
Yes.
And that is, you're going to, I hope, explain it all, but I've got to ask you where you came from originally.
I came from Iowa.
Iowa? What part of Iowa?
Wapello County.
Wapello.
That's right.
Where in heaven's name is Wapello County?
Well, the county seat is Ottumwa, Iowa.
All right.
And it was the major city of about 20,000 people, surrounded by farms that had been settled when the land grant offers were made to people who had come to this country from other countries that weren't doing so well.
Where were your folks coming?
European continent. My father's family came from Germany, and my mother's family all came from England.
Hmm. So what got you going? What was the first thing that you, first interest that you had when you were out in Ottumwa, Iowa?
Well, in Ottumwa, Iowa, the culture centered on things that you could see if you knew about American Gothic. The painting by Grant Wood.
Yeah.
Eldon, Iowa was about 20 miles away, and we would go there to the county fair and have a stand for the PTA and sell hamburgers and make money for the PTA there. And it was a very homogeneous kind of population. And quite, if you look at those people, the two people in the painting, you will know that they have very strict, you could interpret that they have a very strict way of life,
mm-hmm.
and that they have certain boundaries that are not to be crossed. And it is a, it's very reflective of what the farm communities were like.
Mm-hmm.
The other cultural end is the Music Man.
Oh yeah.
Yes, and
and you were and how far were you away from River City? Because you got trouble here in River City, right here in River City. Trouble with a T, and it rhymes with P, and it stands for pool.
So where are you from, John? That's what I said to you.
I'm from Chicago, and used to go to plays, and I loved the Music Man.
Yes, and it was very expressive of exactly what went on in Iowa, because music would liberate the community and it would fulfill the parents to see their children, you know, participating in something that was performance. And so I played the tenor sax, and I was also the tallest person in my, well, I think almost from the very beginning, I was the tallest of anybody in my age group, and so I was the drum majorette.
All right. Well, that's interesting because we on this show we've had several people who started from Iowa who took that that musical background quite seriously, and they moved on, and one that comes to mind is Monty Kolach, who is a pop folk singer from the 60s who is still playing and is a great singer, but came from Iowa, loved music. Now, but you started with music, but what happened from there? You moved on.
Yes, we moved to Miami, Florida when I was 12
years
old.
There's a change.
It was a culture shock beyond measure. Yes.
What brought you down there?
My mother had remarried. She married a man who had not been married before. His name was Charlie. He had been a lifelong bachelor, and he hated the Iowa winters. And he said, well, if we get married, we're moving to Miami, Florida. Have you ever been to the beaches here? There? And my mother said no. So we all went, and we fell in love with it, and that's where we stayed.
What kinds of things? Did you go to high school there?
Absolutely.
All right. And then did you go on to college?
I did.
What happened? Where'd you go?
To the University of Chicago.
Now, that's an interesting switch.
That's
You're back
right.
into the cold again. You obviously did not have the same aversion to cold and misery that your stepfather had.
I fell in love with literature and with a professor who focused on the life of the mind.
And who was that?
It was Professor Albaum, Erwin Albaum, from Columbia University in New York City. And he was the most intelligent person I had ever seen in a classroom, leading these young people into issues and to texts that I could never have imagined before.
Mm. So what kind of literature interested you?
Well, he would lead the class into various areas of endeavor and inquiry, and one of them was Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Another was the Greek philosophers, the Roman philosophers. It was an introduction to a life that had never been mentioned in Iowa.
Yeah, there's not, you don't immediately associate Greek philosophy with Ottumwa, Iowa. Nothing against Ottumwa, Iowa, or against Greek philosophers, but you just don't automatically put them together.
It's an unusual mix.
It is.
In the middle of it
was you.
In the middle of it was this incredible opportunity that came and landed on the doorstep.
And that was?
And this was in the largest high school that I could ever have imagined being in. It was a brand new high school, and I was there for my entire 4 years. There were 3,700 students.
Mm-hmm.
And
in Florida?
In Florida, Miami, Florida. And into that mix came an inspired community of leaders that said, we want to establish an international exchange program with the American Field Service. So we want to establish a chapter. We're going to raise money. We're going to ask students to apply. We're going to select four applications to send to New York, to the main office. And in New York, they will select a student, and we will fund that student to go abroad for an exchange.
I'm guessing that you might have been that person.
Yes. It was incredible. There was actually two of us because there was enough space for two and enough funding for two to go.
Where did you go?
Turkey. Izmir, Turkey. And I was 16 years old. It was the first time I'd ever been on a plane, the first time I had ever been to New York City, the first time I'd ever been to Ireland, where we stopped, Shannon, Ireland. First time I'd ever been to Istanbul, and then on a bus to Izmir, Turkey.
Izmir was the site back in the 1100s or so of a tile-making period in which some of the best Turkish tiles were made in Izmir. And it's a unique, there was a father and son, I guess it was, who were responsible for some of the most beautiful tiles that were used all over the, at that time, the empire, and in many of the mosques and churches.
You have a depth of knowledge that exceeds what you see here in Harbor.
It's just I've been
Harbor Country.
I did a tour of Istanbul, and I learned everything there was to know in 3 days. No, and I did
right?
some research on it. So yes,
wonderful.
But it's a fascinating place, Izmir.
Yes, it is.
So, what did you pick up from being out of the country? As were you still in high school?
I was 16 years old. I was still in high school. I had, when I came back, I was a senior.
What did you learn? Why was that such a transition for you?
I lived with a very religious and very wealthy Turkish family on the Sea of
Marmara.
Right on the Sea of the bay there, mm-hmm. where the NATO headquarters was really right around the bay.
Mm.
Astonishing that this country, so strategically located, you know, between east and west, would have aligned itself with the west mm-hmm. and have incorporated NATO and its installation there on the Izmir coast. And by living with this family in that home with four daughters, they had four daughters,
mm-hmm.
it was remarkable to see that the father and the kind of leadership that he gave to that family because of his religious, his depth of feeling and commitment to his Islamic traditions,
mm-hmm.
praying five times a day in the home with a prayer rug, with his prayer pajamas on. He would come back from his textile, I guess you would call it a shop,
mm-hmm.
but it was sort of where he would do business in the marketplace in the center of the city. He would come home five times a day to pray. It was remarkable. And the kind of sweet and gentle guidance that he gave to his wife and his daughters touched me more deeply than anything I had ever encountered before in the religious communities that I had been raised in Iowa.
When you came back, how did that, this change, this shock, this surprise, how did that play out in your life?
Well, it played out in this remarkable way because this other young student and myself, he had gone to Germany. When we came back, we were the only two that had been on the American Field Service exchange program in the entire state. And it had enlivened the state to see what had gone on at our high school. And so they would invite us to give speeches. You know, we would go all around the state and talk about our experiences. So it was a time of being thrust into a spotlight that we had not anticipated. And forced our minds and our hearts to focus on what we did take away
mm-hmm.
and what was the remarkable experience that we felt could translate into our own culture. And one of the remarkable things that I focused on was the lack of any kind of need for a curfew. In Turkey, there was no disrespect on the part of the teenagers for their parents. It was a culture of loving kindness to the young people, and they respected their parents, and there was no delinquency. Whereas our country was being ravaged by delinquency and by parental discipline measures.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, you know, sort of expressing, I guess, our layer of teenage culture was being enlivened by rock stars that our mm-hmm. parents didn't approve of. And we were rebelling. That was
mm-hmm.
it. It was a time of rebellion. So to have experienced what was going on in Turkey that was so completely different
mm-hmm.
was something that I could talk about and bring into the discussion wherever we would go to give these presentations.
So you ended up at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And what did you study there?
History.
And what area in history was it that, that caught your attention?
Well, you had to choose two areas. And so I chose modern European history and American history.
Okay.
It was a very strict kind of discipline and very demanding at the University of Chicago.
What happened after graduation?
Well, I had met this young man who was a law student.
Uh-oh. I see problems developing here.
Yes, and so we had married.
And
he was starting his legal career, and we were starting a family. And it was 5 years before I decided time for me to go to law school. So that's what I did.
Don't tell me. You succumbed also to law school. All right.
I did.
I've got to stop at this point and give everybody a chance to take a breath, because two lawyers in the same family is always dangerous. We're talking to Judy Munson, who is going to be focusing on prevention of public health problems in just a minute. We'll be right back. We're now back with Judy Munson, a specialist in health, public health. We're going to be talking about something which is really scary, and that is plagues and danger from chemicals and biological warfare and whatnot. But that's the guts of what you've been doing recently. But how did you get into that? You married this lawyer, Lester Munson. I've heard of the man. He's some kind of a sports writer, but he was a lawyer, for pity's sake. You became a lawyer. Did you practice law?
I was a public health specialist at almost every, it ended up being at almost every governmental level. I started out at the regional attorney's office of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and I was prosecuting black lung cases. And that was the pneumoconiosis that the miners would get, and they would apply for black lung benefits. And it was the position of the regional attorney's office to mount a defense to their appeals. If they weren't granted the benefits at the administrative law judge level, they could appeal. And it was the duty of our office to provide the defense for the secretary's decision of denying the benefits. So that was my first job. I was there for 5 years. And then I went to the DuPage County Health Department, where I probably had the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Legally. I know, doesn't that sound impossible? And I was there for 5 years, and then I went to the Illinois Department of Public Health for 5 years. And
well, what happened? What was so exciting about the DuPage County Public Health Department?
They had no real legal attention.
Ah.
They were assigned, typically, to be served by someone from the state's attorney's office. But the state's attorney's office had this duty first, a higher duty that they felt, and probably justifiably so, to the county board. The county board would have a remarkable instinct to try to have their input taken seriously into what was going on at the public health department, even though statutorily there had been this layer of a board of health that had been layered in between the political forces at the county board level, all elected officials, the board of health, all appointed because of their layer, because of their areas of expertise, and then the public health employees who were to carry out the mandates of the statutes.
So you were in a situation at this point where you, as a legal professional working to improve public health, had to deal with political forces that were not necessarily aimed at paying attention to that.
That's right. That's right. And so those instincts of a representation of a client to the best of your ability was able to blossom in a way that was unusual for governmental attorney. And mm-hmm. the reason that it was unusual was because it was not an assignment. You could see, if you could see, something that was not in the best interests of the Board of Health or the public health policy that was being effectuated, and you had an opportunity to interject some statutory defense for the reason why that should not happen,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
then it was something that you could do where you could bring your own attention, your own mental attention, and your own legal expertise that had been developed over time mm-hmm. to assist the client, which would be the health department mm-hmm. and the Board of Health. It was such a challenge to do that and to have some measure of success was extremely invigorating. And so that was why I say it was more fun than you could ever imagine.
Well, you moved on to a different level of government.
That's right.
And what was that?
That was the state. And it happened just serendipitously because what was going on at the county level was so unusual that they would ask me to give speeches at other county of other gatherings of mm-hmm. county health departments and county boards of health. And so I ended up going all around the state making presentations and encouraging affirmative action in terms of, you know, sort of countering the kinds of overreaching, I guess I would use that term, that some of the political forces would be making on the public health sector. And it was noticed by the state health department, and they said, we think we need you here. Hmm. So that's how that happened. It was very nice.
So you got a chance to take it statewide.
That's right.
Politics, leave politics out of public health is
that's
essentially
right.
what you had to deal with.
You understand perfectly.
Okay. In one particular area that I've mentioned, I'm most interested in developing this. You got into talking about how do we protect ourselves? How do we prepare ourselves in case there's a plague, an epidemic of major proportions? How do we go about doing that? Are we prepared, in your experience, for the danger of a pandemic around the world?
We have done a remarkable amount of work on that very topic internationally, locally, nationally, and internationally mm-hmm. since the anthrax attacks of September, October, and November of 2011, pardon me, September 11,
yeah.
2001. And it's been 10 years now that mm-hmm. we have been undergoing this preparation and revising our laws and establishing linkages around the world and enhancing the ability of each country to be able to respond.
Well, but why are we so concerned about world involvement when we've got our own problems here?
We could stay here and we could concentrate on what goes on here, except for something that happened in 2003. It was called the SARS epidemic that traveled around the globe on an airplane.
Mm.
And it did not have a name. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know where it came from. We had nothing to prevent it, and we had nothing to cure it. It scared public health to death. And so it was obviously time to ignore the jurisdictional boundaries of what the statute said was your jurisdiction, mm-hmm. the county level or the state level or the national level, because the disease of SARS did not recognize any of those boundaries. Mm-hmm. So the time had come to plan internationally for how to address such an expanding assignment.
Sure. How did you go about doing that, this preparation? Because obviously there are, we have many, many different societies in the world, countries, tribes, peoples, languages, and, you know, just to say to them, hey, you know, this disease can go around the world real rapidly because of error or transportation, is just not automatically going to be sold or recognized, is it? Or what was the sales job that you had to do? Or was it? Was it just all of a sudden everybody said, hey, this is real, let's do it?
It was one of the most frightening things that could have been experienced by the localities that had SARS come into its midst. Mm. And it was watching and helping and trying to come up with immediate measures to counteract what was happening, that the enormity of the job was visualized and the enormity of the task of doing something about it was undertaken then by the World Health Organization with its headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, and every country signed on to help to make the revisions in the international health regulations. It's an international treaty, in order to make sure that we were not going to have this same kind of lack of unified response ever again. I mm-hmm. think if I was to come up with the telling example on our continent, it would be what happened in Toronto in 2003. The World Health
SARS?
That's right. When SARS came to Toronto, it was devastating because of those four characteristics that I had mentioned. They didn't know where it came from. They didn't know how it was transmitted. They didn't know. They had no medication. They just had to try to deal with it as each individual would get ill. What mm-hmm. they found out was that in the hospitals, when the person would appear and be put into their hospital room, it was the hospital workers that would then catch it. Mm. So they had to make sure that the hospital worker did not go home with it to spread it there. Mm. So they ended up having to lock down four hospitals so that no one can come in and no one could go out because of having to deal with SARS, this unknown, previously unknown pathogen, a virus that had not been in a human locus before. Mm-hmm. And it was when the public health people who tried to help out in every way they possibly could would come up against laws that were antiquated, that did not provide them with the kind of tools that they needed to address this disastrous effect in their city, that they knew that they had to act. It was the World Health Organization in Geneva that would issue travel warnings, travel alerts, and that resulted in people who had conferences already planned for Toronto, a destination city for conferences and conventions, and the hotels were, you know, full with reservations, but then they were all canceled.
So it had a huge economic impact. When even the danger, the beginning of such an outbreak.
That's right.
What are the laws that had to be changed, and our legal way of looking at this? What had to be changed?
That's just such a wonderful question, because that's what they had to grapple with immediately, was whether or not there was authority on the part of the public health institutions to say, this is an emergency, there is an outbreak of an unknown disease in this building, we are going to now quarantine this building, and we require all of you to be tested before you can leave. Mm-hmm. Or we would require that all of you, because you have been exposed, will have to take this medication mm-hmm. for 6 weeks. Or we require that, you know, whatever the measure might be that would be the proper antidote for that particular pathogen, you know, could actually be implemented under those circumstances. Whether there was the ability to say, we're going to turn this building that you're in into a hospital. We're going to commandeer it. Mm-hmm. We're going, because of this emergency, we're going to take it over for the 30 days during the length of time the emergency has been declared. And we are going to say that it's going to be the site where we're going to treat you. That had never been anything that they had had before, that they needed to have the ability to share health information with law enforcement individuals if there was some reason to suspect that there was a bioterrorism event that had taken place that had resulted in that particular emergency. They needed to be able to say to the law enforcement people that, yes, we have another person over here who has that same disease. There might be something there that would have a connection to what it is we're trying to prevent or trying to find the source of, all having those issues having emanated from the anthrax events in 2001. So it was this combination of the first bioterrorism attack in the United States resulting in death.
It was the anthrax.
The anthrax. The internationalization of an emerging infectious disease that had never been in a human being before. The SARS epidemic. And then it was the threat of an avian influenza pandemic that we're still trying to make sure stays under wraps, mm-hmm. that does not emerge from the fowl, the wild fowl, and the domestic chicken and duck.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Judy Munson. We're beginning to talk about how do we prepare and protect ourselves from the horrors of a pandemic, of a disease, or a biological attack that gets out of hand. We'll be right back. We're now back with Judy Munson, talking from a public health and legal standpoint as to preparation. Now, Judy, in talking about, you talked about SARS and anthrax and avian flu.
Right.
Those are things that everybody has lived through recently. But luckily, we did not have, in each of those cases, what we view as the Black Plague going through Europe back in the 13, 14, 1500s, that hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people died. High percentages of the population barely survived. Now, that's what you're trying to prevent.
That's right. And what we fear, of course, is that there will be some outbreak that mirrors exactly what you have described. That's why the fear of the avian influenza is so great. We're trying to contain it so that it does not break out of the bird population or the chicken population, fowl, really, into the human site. And it is because of its deadly nature. If we were just to go over some of the percentages of people who are expected that they would be dead if the disease was to run rampant, we would say that if there was a smallpox epidemic, that there would be a 33% lethality rate. In other words, one-third of the people who got it would die. If we were to talk about an anthrax incident, again, that would be an expectation that if it was the inhalation anthrax, that the likelihood of death would be so great that you would expect it. There would be very few people who would be able to survive once they had contracted it. If you're talking about SARS, you could say, well, yes, there were 8,000 cases and 800 deaths. So you could say with pretty positive confidence that it was a 10% lethality rate.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to avian influenza, it's about a 77% rate.
Ouch.
Yes. And so it is that fear that it's avian influenza that is going to break out of the wild fowl and the domestic chickens that has public health ready to act on a moment's notice. So when the swine flu pandemic hit in 2009 with a lethality rate of about less than 1%, it was, in a sense, a free test of all of the measures that had been put in place around the globe to address a pandemic.
How did we do?
I would say we get an A+. And yet, it was because there was such a low lethality rate, low mortality, that people would say, well, what's the problem?
Right.
What's the problem? I'm not getting that shot. Why am I going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my goodness. You know, we're not getting out the message that we need to get out.
What is the message? What is the message that we need to give out and hear people need to pay attention to?
Listen to the director of your state health department, and when he says you can get the swine flu vaccine now, go and get it. When he says you can go to your local health department and get it, go. When he says that now it's available everywhere and these are the age groups that are at greatest risk, pay attention, because that's going to be the greatest preventer that we have for whatever it is that might be coming down the road at some point in the future. We cannot predict it, as we can see. We had never had swine flu as a pandemic ever before.
Well, I thought we had it back in 1918.
That was a different pandemic.
Okay.
That was we had a swine flu scare in 1976 in this country when we had an effort to have a nationwide vaccination program that didn't go well. And I think that experience was really one of the things that prevented a lot of people from saying, oh, yes, let me rush out and get my
vaccination. That's exactly right. I remember that.
You do remember.
I do remember it. And I remember getting the shot, and then it started having bad reactions with some people.
That's right.
And I ended up as United States Attorney having to defend the government against lawsuits that people got Guillain-Barré syndrome after the shot.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's those articles that were written about that experience that resonate to this day with the physicians who have been trained in other countries and who have read the journal articles and who are reluctant to implement anything that, sort of might duplicate one more time what had happened then in 1976,
mm-hmm.
so that there was not that same urgency to of messages to the population in other countries to, yes, be sure and go out and get your vaccination.
So what's the solution to that? I mean, right now we have It's an interesting phenomenon floating around our society. We want to be immune from the bad things that can happen to us. We don't want to have to worry about the flu. We don't want to have to worry about, we're trying to prevent colds and polio and measles and all this by preventative measures. On the other hand, we then have a concern by people who have had experience with autism, that, oh, if we get our shots, that in itself can cause autism. So we have that struggle. So that we're worried about the disease. We're worried about the effect. We're also worried about the prevention. And I'm going to toss one else out to you, and that is, what happens when there's an epidemic? Are you prepared for the situation where there is a serious health risk floating around in our society, big society or small, all right? But there are people who refuse to accept that this is a problem, and they say, you say, quarantine? What quarantine? This is America. I have freedom of movement. I'm an American here. You can't stop me from going into that area, or you can't stop me from going out. What about that?
That's one of the things that the governments have had to struggle with, is to how to come up with the kind of authorities that public health directors need to have when there is this major threat. And what they have done is the federal government, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. I was there working with the new public health law program. When they contracted out for the Georgetown Center for Law and the Public's Health to come up with a model act that would incorporate the kind of powers and duties that were required for this very example, for the need to quarantine and the need to isolate even in the event when the individual did not give consent, and how to handle that situation. And so that model act was promoted to the various states, all 50 states, saying, please take a look at these measures and see if you have those same powers and duties in your statutory panoply of powers for your public health people. If you don't, consider whether or not you would adopt some of them. And so that was all mounted in within 3 months of the anthrax events in 2001. And every state has reviewed that model act and has, to a certain degree, undertaken some measure of adoption of some of the provisions.
So Michigan has adopted that?
It doesn't adopt. There hasn't been any state that has adopted the entire model act, because every state has had its own statutory framework mm-hmm. for dealing with the various governmental structure itself and for the powers and duties that it then can set forth, given whatever that structure looks like. But they have taken some. And there is, on the website at the Georgetown Center, a listing of what the states have done in each case for the various powers and duties. When it came to Illinois, which is the one I know, and worked with intimately, there was this struggle between those who were there in the room to defend the private right
mm-hmm.
versus those, not versus, but in the same room with the same people who were trying to promote the public good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no more classic war front than the private right versus public good when it comes to a measure of, can you quarantine me?
Mm-hmm.
Can you isolate me? Can you do that? And if so, for how long? And when do I get to challenge that? And who would be the person who would decide whether or not my position was going to prevail over your position?
Mm-hmm.
And so that struggle, I was there in the room when that went on between the forces that were there representing individuals and the forces that were there saying we'll need to have some authority to act.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a remarkable thing that happened, because they did come to an agreement on what would be in that statute and what provisions would be promoted with the legislature, with the General Assembly. It was a remarkable time, because we had the person who was sponsoring it in the House in Illinois, Sarah Feigenholz, and the person who was sponsoring it in the Senate, Senator Obama. And when they introduced it, it had come out of this room where the forces had forged an agreement, and it was adopted unanimously.
Mm.
It was the most remarkable piece of legislation ever to hit the Illinois Springfield.
People actually agreed in the legislature.
Right.
I can't. The only thing they usually agree upon is tributes to a county treasurer. So you got it. It's on the books.
It is on the books.
It is a compromise then.
Yes.
Between those who say, I've got rights of privacy, you can't force me to do things that I don't want to do, and those who say, look, the danger here is to the broader society, and a lot more bad things can happen to individuals if you don't listen to us.
That's perfectly stated. Perfectly stated.
Well, the problem is always not just in the creation of a structure to make things work in a crisis, but it's the crisis itself. The crisis can, when we have one of these crises, things tend not to work according to the plan. Now, we're going to talk about that in just a minute, but I want to take a break right now. We're talking to Judy Munson about how do we prepare for the real possibility of death, injury, from all different kinds of mass problems with disease and chemicals and whatnot. We'll be right back. We're now back with Judy Munson talking about public health, disease, epidemics, and how do we prepare for them. Judy, I've been involved in cases where we came up with, as a U.S. attorney or as a part of the Department of Justice or prosecuting attorney, we had all kinds of wonderful statutory and administrative procedures that on the face looked just beautiful, and they could meet all those interests, and then something happens and it all goes out the window and we start inventing because it doesn't quite fit, or people didn't get the message to begin with and so they don't understand where those procedures are. How do we go about making this work in a real life situation?
I think the first thing is education. And in my field, I consider that the education of the attorneys is probably the most important thing. I teach this course on public health emergency law, domestic and international, at the John Marshall Law School. I also, they're in the city of Chicago, I also teach it in a law school in the Czech Republic. It is essential, in my opinion, for law students to know about these provisions, about what can be done under the declaration of an emergency by a governor, and that they need to be able to advise their clients when there is some need for the state to act. And if they aren't aware of what these emergency provisions are, then they're not going to be able to guide their clients into the proper framework for being able to assist in the governmental response that needs to be made. And so, in the class that I teach at John Marshall, just this last class period, we were reading the very words of what a governor can do when it comes time to declare an emergency. And as we read it, we said, well, what was the last time that you know of that the governor has declared an emergency, a disaster? When was the last time? And they all looked up and they said, 2 weeks ago. When the threat of the snowstorm, the historic snowstorm, was about to hit the state of Illinois. And we said, well, could he do it? Did he have the statutory authority to do it? We read the words one more time, and the governor can declare a disaster when there is a threat or an actual disaster. His declaration can last for 30 days. It has these requirements of what kind of threats might be appropriate for him to say, yes, this is a declaration of an emergency. And so we remarked at that time that the governor had an attorney in his office who said to him, yes, you do have the authority. Go ahead and declare the emergency.
All right, so now that's fine. That's all well and good. All right, we all know about government, and government just, you know, it's great. They just declare emergencies. But is it the first time that all these various agencies that have to work together, do we wait for that emergency to happen or that threat to happen? Or is there any kind of other kind of preparation that we do beforehand to see how this all can work together?
That's such a great question, because for the last 10 years, the federal government has funded universities and state governments to work together to come up with drills and exercises and tabletop scenarios to work through these various possibilities that they might have to deal with on some emergency basis. It could be something that they've already encountered before, something that we have now addressed, anthrax, that's usually one of them that's in there, SARS, but what about the one that we don't know about? The one that we didn't know was coming was swine flu, right? No one expected that one at all. And so we're trying to make certain that there is the knowledge base among the various agencies that will have to work together about whom to contact, whose job is going to be what, where the emergency operations center is, who's going to be the first responders, are the first responders actually, you know, immunized against whatever it is the threat might be, are there personal protection equipments available for the people who will be the first responders, is there going to be a place where everyone can be reached instantly if they need to be contacted in order to get an answer. And so, yes, the answer is that there has been a massive, massive effort to train the workforce.
Let me tell you, I was a part of two different scenarios, events, in which it became extremely important that there be preparation. And I'll tell you that the biggest difficulty in getting people prepared is to get the parties, the players, this department, that department, to actually get serious about it. And I know in one situation, it was after a near meltdown at Three Mile Island. We looked in nuclear power, in the nuclear power world, we looked to find a way to quantify the difficulties and how do we react to it and what preparation, what, and I was shocked. I was at a meeting. I was on a board in which a presentation was being made by somebody who was telling how the NRC was prepared and the nuclear power industry was prepared. And they went through 10 different levels and they said, okay, we have a class 10 problem. And we have run these through these various things. A fire in a wastebasket might be a class 10 irregularity or event. And then we went up to class 9. And for each of those, they had preparation. They had drills. And they had plans. And then they came, I was sitting there listening half dazed by all these numbers. And he came to number 2, and he said, and then we have a class 2, and we've run 7 drills on class 2 problems. And then he moved on. And I said, wait a minute. What's a class 1? Do you have those? He said, well, those are meltdowns. And I said, well, have you done computer simulations, or have you done drills on those? Oh, no, we wouldn't do that. I said, well, why not? Is it because it would never happen? I said, the worst event you had not done computer simulations on, nor had you done any drills on, and it's a core meltdown, it's the China syndrome that everybody paints, and you've never done it. Well, yes, because that would never happen. The likelihood of it happening. I said, excuse me, isn't that what happened at Three Mile Island, which is why we're sitting here, or it came close to happening. So that was one. And the other one was a situation in which I was supposed to be in charge of putting together the response team for a particular situation. And I was put in charge because they had to move it up to a level where there was some authority behind getting people to participate in the drill. They didn't want to participate in the drill. And so I had to literally order people to give up a weekend to participate in this drill. And it was, and they never forgave me for it because it inconvenienced their weekend. But if they hadn't, we would have no coterie of people out there who could, when called upon in the middle of the night to deal with one of these problems, had no experience in where to go, who to talk to, what it's like to be in a bunker or in a headquarters, and everything is going south all around you. And so, at any rate, this is a very practical problem of taking your statutory authority and turning it into reality and turning it into something where people have to really, really take it seriously, and we can carry it out. So I don't envy you your educational and your training component of your work. Now, very quickly, because we're coming out to the end of our time, unfortunately, what is the International Collaborative for Public Health Emergency Preparedness? What is that?
Thank you very much for asking. But first of all, just let me say that I applaud you for your efforts to get the training into the heart of the workforce that needs to have it, because that is exactly what is needed, is that kind of leadership. When it comes to the International Collaborative, the notion was that, yes, we are one world. Yes, we do have the international health regulations, but we have only ministerial cooperation. There has not been any major effort to try to establish significant linkages by the people on the ground, and to actually know what the structure is from country to country. And so the idea was to at least start something that would try to enhance the knowledge base here in this country with the knowledge base in the public health sector in another country. What we selected first was the Czech Republic, because we had already established a linkage at the John Marshall Law School with a significant professional entities in the Czech Republic. We now have a very strong linkage with the Ministry of Health there and with universities that have courses that are taught now in this area. And it is quite rewarding to see the kind of results that can come from actually sharing stories. Probably the most significant of the workshops that we hold each year was held last March in Brno.
In the Czech Republic.
In the Czech Republic. And it was a session where the leadership of the public health sector here in Illinois was invited to give a presentation to the first responders in the Czech Republic. There were translators, the immediate translations were possible with headsets for everything that was being said. And the remarkable exchange of experiences on the swine flu pandemic was electrifying, to see what messages that just by sharing them with each other could result in this enhancement of what was possible, given the strenuousness of the circumstances that both leaders had to go through during that first real trial of what kind of authorities they had under the international health regulations regarding this, thank goodness, this pandemic with such a low lethality rate.
All right. Now we get down to the real serious part of education. Websites. Where can our listeners, if they want to learn about preparation for these sorts of horrible possibilities, and how they can prepare themselves or encourage their governmental officials to prepare, Where can we go to enhance our information? Do you have a website for us?
Yes, I do. It's the Get Ready website for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It tells you what you as a homeowner need to know to have in place in your own home for any emergency that might be coming down the road, which is very difficult to predict. You can also just enhance your own knowledge base about what kind of threats are existing at the present time.
And what's that website?
The Get Ready?
Yes.
www.getready.org.
All right. Yes. www.getready.org. And if they want to learn more about your organization, do you have a website?
Actually, I would direct them to the John Marshall Law School website for the Czech Slovak Study Institute.
All right, so that would be
www.jmls.edu.
All right. We've been talking to Judy Munson. Thank you very much for your time and the interest and your enthusiasm on this. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And you know our mantra that if you show respect, respect will be shown to you.